You guys just get right to it. Hey, everybody. My name is Daisy Gladi. I'm alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. Thank you, Billy, and the group for having me. Let me get this out of the way. I have pink nail polish on. I don't usually wear pink nail polish. I have three girls. One of the blessings of AA is God has put me in custody of three of his children. And they wanted to have a spa day today because mommy wasn't home. And I ran out of time and I didn't have time to take it off. So if you see me like this and you're wondering what is going on, that's what it is. Plus, it makes me, now you know, so I don't feel nearly as uncomfortable. You guys are judging me. But I am grateful to be here. And, you know, I've been raised to say yes to NAA requests. I mean, that was instilled in me early on. And if I can do it, I'm gonna show up. And we were just talking before the meeting. If I would have known it was Master Sunday, my wife asked me if I would have told Billy no, and I said, absolutely, I would have asked for another date. But but we're here, and I'm missing the final round, but it's fine. I joke about it, but really, I can't, and I never, don't think I ever will be able to do enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to repay the debt that I owe the men and women that came before me and showed me the way and spent countless, countless hours so a guy like me could have the life that I have today. And so I'm happy to be here. You know, I really am. My sobriety is October 17th of 2002. I have a sponsor in a home group, and I always say those are the three most important things that have ever come out of my mouth. Those are the foundations on which my recovery is built. I am fairly certain at this point in my recovery that I wouldn't be here without those three things. I have a sponsor who guides me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and gives me an objective view of my life. I tell the guys when I start sponsoring, I don't micromanage your life. I can't make you do anything, but he's that one clear voice, right? I'm emotionally invested in the decisions that I make. Even at 23 years sober, I think all of them are really good ideas. And you're going to hear some of them. They're not really that good. And if I'm willing to be current with him and I talk to him, he can say, hey man, you know, what about this? Like he knows he's known me for 22 years. And I'll be honest with you, he moved to Arizona, and it's been difficult. It has been difficult for me, to be current for a little while. I do have an appointment with him right after this meeting to talk to him. I made sure, because I've started to come to understand that why people with a lot of time can walk out of AA. You know what I mean? There's a lot of stuff. If, you know, there's a lot of blessings that come with being sober. And the problem is I got to remember that I can't let the life AA gave me get in the way of my AA life. You know what I mean? And so it's been a struggle, but I'm still active enough in Alcoholics Anonymous that like drinking hasn't been a thought, but there's, you know, there's irritability, there's restlessness, there's discontent. And so I made sure when I was on my way up here, I was like, hey, I'm gonna have a couple hours in the car, you know, are you available? And so we have an appointment after this. I have a home group, you know, and it's the place, my home base in AA, and people know me, and I can walk in the room and they can ask me how I'm doing. And I'm like, I'm fine. I'm good. You know, and they can look at me and say, hey, really, what's up? Right. I don't know if there's anybody else in here like me, but I still rather look good in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to let you know that I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I love helping people. Love it. I'll go to the mat for alcoholics. But when it comes to asking for help, it's still like, you know, pulling teeth for me. It's still hard. And so, you know, I had a home group for 20 years and it was really difficult post-COVID for me to figure out what I was going to do. And I went to this meeting and I knew a couple of the guys, and at 20 years sober, I felt like I was a new guy, right? Cause they were greeters and they shook my hand and they said, come join us. There's room for one more. Same way with like when I was brand new. And I sort of knew that that was where I belong. So my new home group is New Market Tuesday night in New Market, Maryland. If you're ever down or up, it's up. If you're up that way, you know, we'd love to have you. And I have my sobriety date, and I say this anytime I get the opportunity to share. It's the date that my life changed, and I'm sure that's the same for you guys, right? And And what it really means to me is like before my sobriety, I think there was pain, chaos, suffering, and misery for me and the people that love me. And after, if I since I've been willing to do what's in the program of action in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've gotten what the book promises, a life that's happy, joyous, and free. Right. And that doesn't mean that I've had relationships and money and cars and houses and all that stuff. It promises happy, joyous, and free. And that's what's happened for me and the people that love me, right? And that's one of the reasons, and I'll get into that about like, my mom knew where I was every day for the last 10 years of her life, right? And I replaced the peace of mind that she lost for the 17 years that I was drinking. And when I talk about the debts, I have a debt, I have the debt to the people that help me, but I have a debt to Alcoholics Anonymous for restoring that. Right, that's one of the blessings for me. Right, again, it's not about the cash and prizes. It really isn't. I mean, we can. It's easy to get caught up. I'm a want machine. I mean, my wife will tell you. Like, I'll tell you a quick story about how bad it is. About 12 years sober, we were putting a deck on our house, right? They put the posts in for the deck. And I had a sponsorship meeting at my house. My grand sponsor and my sponsor and all of us were there. And I was literally yelling about the deck is too small. Now there's only posts. I haven't seen anything. I haven't seen a thing. And I'm like, this is gonna suck, right? Because I want more. I want bigger. I want better. I think I deserve it. And it took me a long time into sobriety to realize that sobriety isn't really about the cash and prizes and me showing you how well I'm doing. That has nothing to do with it, right? We meet in our brokenness in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It's not about me showing you how good I'm doing. And so I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened, and hopefully what I'm like today. And alcoholism affected my life from a very young age. My dad was an alcoholic. I know that because I have a 30-day chip, 60-day chip, 90-day chip his. I have a medallion from a rehab, and I have 12 and 12, and I have a 24-hour day book that has phone numbers in it, and so I know he tried. But we were living in Minnesota, and I woke up one night and I heard my mom crying, and I walked out and there were police officers there, and I asked her what was wrong, and she said, "Daddy's dead," and my dad had taken his own life. And so shortly thereafter we moved to Maryland to be closer to family. And I at the time I didn't realize the things, how any of this stuff really until later. But I just felt awkward, right? I felt awkward. And really what it was is it was at that early age that I was comparing everybody's outsides to the way I felt inside. And what it because we moved into this upper middle class white community, and there weren't any many people that looked like me. Everybody had two parents, right? We had bigger houses. We had a split level. This was in the 80s. They were driving imports, right? Toyotas and Mercedes were a big deal back in the 80s, and my mom was driving a copper Pontiac station wagon, right? Their kids were wearing polos and Izods, and I was wearing Garanimals. I mean, it's like literally here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we feel different than our fellows. My fourth grade picture is absolute proof that I was different than my fellows, right? And so, my dad being alcoholic doesn't make me alcoholic. It may be wildly uncomfortable, doesn't make me alcoholic. What makes me alcoholic is what happens when I drink beverage alcohol, right? I have a different reaction than 90% of the population. It is it's the elixir to life, right? And what happened for me, my first drink wasn't a big deal. We were walking home from school, and I was in high school, and we were walking home, and we were cutting through the woods, and we're along the path, and we found a six pack of beer. And the guys that were there with me just popped it open and started drinking it like they knew what they were doing, right? And then they held one out and said, "Here, have some." Now at that point, I mean, I hadn't really ever thought about drinking. I didn't care. I'm first generation in this country. I didn't know. It didn't matter to me. But at that moment, my head said, "If you don't do this, they'll never ask you to do anything ever again." And that'll be a theme that runs through, I mean, my entire life, basically. And so I drank. Now, I didn't get drunk that night. It was warm beer we found in a park. It was disgusting. But I went home, and now I know when we talk about the obsession of the mind, I feel like that's what happened for me at that point. Because what happened was, for the next 2 weeks until I went to my first keg party, all I did was think about alcohol. I wanted to know what it tasted like, what it smelled like, what the big deal was, why everybody talked about it. I started paying attention to like the Absolut magazine ads, right? I mean, all the stuff. And I went to my first keg party, and I remember having the red cup. I remember going to the keg. I remember drinking that cup, and I remember waking up the next day. And so, to me, that's, you hear the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. It's not a craving. And the best way it's been ever described to me is, you drink until you run out, pass out, or blackout, right? And that's what happened. I blacked out that night. And so I don't, my first drink, there's no, I don't really drink socially. I don't understand drinking socially. The normal non-alcoholic will drink alcohol as a beverage. Now, I mean, that makes sense, right? But when you really, I want you to really think about what that means. It's a beverage in the same category as water, soda, tea, and milk, right? They'll drink a Corona on a hot day to quench their thirst after mowing the lawn, and they won't even finish it. That's not, I mean, it's just, it literally is just another liquid to them, right? But to me, what it does is it washes away the insecurity, the inferiority, the inadequacy. It levels the playing field and allows me to look you in the eye, right? That doesn't happen for the normal average drinker. My sponsor talks all the time about the alcoholic talking about the magic, right? With alcohol, you take a couple sips, it gets about halfway down, you feel the burn, you can breathe, and you feel the magic starting to happen. The non-alcoholic will never talk about alcohol being magic. They just won't. They just won't, right? And what it does for me, like, the best way I can describe it is it changes my perception of you. But more importantly, it changes my perception of the way that you think about me, right? And that's what allows me to live comfortably with you. I can tell you that from the very young age, I hated what I saw in the mirror. I wanted to be taller, skinnier, whiter, more athletic. I wanted to be all of it because I didn't see what I saw when I looked at you. And when I drank, I say this, when I drank, I could become the Hindu Brad Pitt. Right, I could stand taller, I was sexier, I was like, I could talk to girls and do all that stuff. And again, that's the magic, right? Normal non-alcoholic drinkers, that doesn't happen to them. It just doesn't. And that's the hardest part for me to understand, was hard for me to understand, right? It was it I didn't understand, like, how, if I drink this liquid and they drink this liquid, that it has this effect on me, but it doesn't on them, right? And so I went to high school, and I grew up in the 80s, and I give you a picture of what I look like. If you know the movie 16 Candles, there's a character, Ducky. I was like a new wave mod kid. It was awful. I had bangs, I had a rat tail, I had earrings, I had black leather tie, peg leg jeans. I like a cross between Don Johnson and Billy Idol. It was so bad. And we play, and then so there was my group of weirdos, and then, like, the jocks and everybody. And so we got picked on a lot. And I had, a few close friends in high school, in the school. And then what I did was, I worked for a place called Moto Photo, where we used to develop film. Most people who are in this room look like they remember that. I used to belong to a young people's group, and nobody knew what I was talking about. And so I used to be able to, I had the laminating machine and the photo thing, so I made fake IDs. And I started to hang out with a lot of my mom's friends' kids, right? A bunch of Indian kids. And we used to have all these house parties, and it was great. And I would get all the alcohol, and there was this one other Indian kid who was like the druggie, and we were like the central point of all the parties, right? We were always out in the car doing what we were doing while everybody was inside, and people would come to us. And now, you sort of like create the fellowship you create, right? At that time. And we were doing it, and it was fun. And I had a lot of fun in high school, right? I had a lot of fun. I didn't have to try very hard in school, and it just wasn't a problem. It was on the weekends, it was when we could get it, and it was just a lot of fun. And then My senior year, my mom wanted to pay for a trip for me to go on the senior trip, and it was to Rio de Janeiro. I was excited. I was totally excited until I saw the list of everybody that was going. It turned out to be all it was like the huge group of jocks that were picking on me for 3.5 years. I was so terrified that I tried to get my money back. And I couldn't explain to my mom why I wanted, could lose the deposit or any of that. So I'm afraid that I'm going to get my butt kicked up and down the beaches of Ipanema for 10 days. And so I got to go. Get on the plane, sitting right in the middle seat in between two of these football players, because why not get the middle seat, right? And I knew these guys from junior high and stuff, and but we were on opposite sides for high school. And we take off, and I can't tell you if it was the 80s or international waters or whatever, but the flight attendant came by and asked us if we wanted anything to drink, and we just started ordering airplane bottles, one after another, one after another. And from that day until the day until we landed, we didn't take a sober breath. There was no drinking age down in Brazil, and instead of getting my butt kicked up and down the beaches of Ipanema, we were singing show tunes down the beaches of Ipanema. And we got back, and this is the best example of what alcohol does for me. We got back, and I'm pulling in the parking lot, and I'm going to my side of the parking lot where the losers hang out, and they went like this. They were all out there at the smoking area and stuff, and they went like this and waved me over. And you hear it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time, that feeling that you had arrived, right? And that was that moment for me. And it was the point in my life where alcohol gave me the power to be with the people I thought I wanted to be with, doing the things I wanted to do that I couldn't do by myself, right? And alcohol afforded me the opportunities. Alcohol afforded me a lot of opportunities while I was drinking. Before, you know, it did something for me long before it did anything to me. You know what I mean? And it was one of those, it's one of those moments, like when I talk to the guys I sponsor, I talk about those pinnacle moments in your drinking, right? There's these moments where sort of like everything lines up, right? You don't overshoot the mark, right? And you got the right mix, and it's like the sky parts, the angels sing, and you're like, this is it. This is why I do what I do. This is the sense of ease and comfort that I'm searching for, right? And the thing is to me, for me, I under for me, I have the understanding now that when the book talks about chasing into the gates of insanity or death, for me, it's that feeling. Because I think that I can recreate that feeling over and over and over again. The problem is I can't. There's two problems. I can't reproduce it over and over and over again, but it does happen enough for me to think that I can do it over and over and over again. So I'll continue to chase it, right? And so I got out of high school. I went to the University of Maryland, and I commuted for a couple of years, and my drinking took off to another level, and I started to become a different person. I started to cheat in school, which I had never done before. I started to cheat on girlfriends, which I had never done before. These guys were breaking into cars and stealing radios and radar detectors, and I didn't need the money, but they had asked me. And again, if I said no, they wouldn't ask me to do anything ever again, right? And so I did that, and that led to my first arrest. And what happened was that I started to change so much that all those Indian kids that I used to hang out with started to get tired of me, and they didn't want me around, right? I mean, we're talking about like when cheating on a girlfriend and you're in this small little Indian community in the student union, and they're yelling back and forth, and you're fighting with the guy who's now dating you. I mean, it was like a bad drama, TV drama. And but they all just didn't want me around because I was causing trouble. And so that other Indian kid that I had hung out with had pledged a fraternity. And that sounded like a great idea. I mean, I had watched Animal House, right? I get it. And you pay them, you can drink as much as you want, and they have to be your friends. I quickly learned that they don't have to be your friends. If you're an a-hole, you're an a-hole, and they don't have to hang out with you. But I pledged that fraternity, and I moved off campus, and I was pledging, while I'm pledging this fraternity, I people would ask me to go out and do things all the time, and this is where I started to really suffer consequences for drinking, because it didn't matter whether I had a test the next day, I had work the next day, I had to meet my family the next day. If they asked me to go out, I was going out. And it was twofold, right? It was I was afraid they weren't going to ask me, but it was also I was afraid that I was going to miss it. I don't know if you guys ever know, when you're going to miss it, whatever it is. If I don't go, I'm going to miss it. And so I never, and here's what the crazy part about that. I didn't really feel like I missed it when I actually went out because I didn't know what it was. Right. But I continued to, it was the same as like chasing that feeling. Like I didn't know what it was going to be, but I had to be there in case it happened. But I'm pledging this fraternity and I'm living off campus, and I come back from a pledge party one night, and I drove drunk, and this will be my probably the only opinion I'll say up here is that I drove drunk a lot. I'm not proud of it at all. I'm grateful, and I'm somehow blessed that nothing ever happened. But we tell stories about drunk driving and Alcoholics Anonymous from the podium, and people laugh and stuff. And I think we really need to be careful about that, because you don't know who's in the room and whose life's been affected by a drunk driver. And so I always try to make sure that I'm clear that I'm not proud of what happened, and I don't think any of it's funny. But I got home that night, and my mom called me. And now she lives about 35 minutes away, and from campus, and she wanted me to come home. She said she wasn't feeling well, and I said I couldn't. She called me back a couple hours later and said she was throwing up and really needed me to come home. I said I can't. And she called me back again. And I mumbled something into the phone. And the next call I got was 10 o'clock in the morning. And my uncle had called me and to tell me my mom had a heart attack. And I didn't make it to the hospital until about 1 o'clock that afternoon, because I couldn't get out of bed. I walk in there, and I'm walking. She's there, and I met with all my extended family, my grandfather, my uncles, my aunts, my cousins, my sister, and I met with the look, right? And if you're alcoholic of my type, you know the look. How could you? Why did you? You did it again, but you promised. And the answer isn't screw, the conscious answer isn't screw you, I want to drink, right? That's not the conscious answer. But what I feel when I met with the look is that feeling of incomprehensible demoralization it talks about in the book, right? A feeling that I'm intimate with, unfortunately, but I am. And you don't really have an answer, right? Because they have this despair in their eyes because they just don't understand. They just don't. And at some point, really, I don't, But I do know that when I need to get what I need to be okay in the world, the people closest to me become collateral damage, right? And I'm gonna just say, in my experience, in my case, I know this isn't true for everybody, is that I'm gonna say I'm sorry. And they're gonna say, just don't do it again. Because they love me so much, and they want to make it, and they just want it to be different. And they don't know how to make it different, right? My sponsor talks about, the alcoholic hears, you get, the alcoholic is told they get one more chance. The alcoholic hears, great, I get three more chances, right? And that was literally how I lived my life, because I would just say, I'm sorry. My mom was in the ICU for a while, and I was terrified. Well, let me go step back. I thought that I was terrified. Because if she passed away, it was just going to be me and my sister, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous many years later and got down to the causes and conditions of my drinking. And the truth was, I was still pledging that fraternity. And I was afraid that if I didn't go to their events instead of go see my mom, that they wouldn't have let me in. That's the guilt and shame that I bring into Alcoholics Anonymous, right? That's the guilt and shame that I drink over. That's the guilt and shame that I have to live with. And I talk about this. The best analogy that I have is If you take a line or a pencil and draw a line on a piece of paper, and if you take the eraser, then you take an eraser and you erase that line, you'll still know that the line was always there, right? To me, that's that line between right and wrong, right? And for me, when and what happens is I believe that we're all don't believe anybody's innately evil. For me, right? I believe that if things happen and people do bad things and then they get that way, whatever. So I know the difference between right and wrong, right? But when my alcoholism starts to take hold, that line starts to fade, right? And it fades a little bit more. And then I'm hanging out with people that are doing what I'm doing, right? They've had three DUIs, I haven't had any, or I've had three and I've had one. And it just becomes I'm hanging out with lesser companions, like it talks about in the book. And what happens is slowly but surely, right starts to become wrong and wrong starts to become right. Right. And to me, it's that's the, and that's how I describe that the alcoholic life is the only one that I know. Because somewhere along the way, I go from knowing what's right and to doing right to doing what is wrong. And I know it's wrong. Right. When the book talks about that deep down inside every man, woman, child is the fundamental idea of God, to me, I would have that little voice when I'm about to do something wrong. It would say, "Don't do it." You just—it's like it could be a split second, it could be for a minute, but it's there. And what I would do is just drown it out with, Johnny Walker Black or Heineken or whatever it was, so I didn't have to listen to it. And then I was doing wrong, and I continued to do wrong, and I continued to do wrong, and wrong became right in my life, right? And so. I got kicked out of the University of Maryland shortly thereafter because I wasn't going to school. I was literally John Belushi from Animal House. I mean, I told you they would ask me and I wouldn't do it. I mean, we'd have beer Olympics and I would be the anchor man for all of it. We would do two-story beer bongs. I mean, it was party time. And at that point, I started to follow the Grateful Dead, which you guys can make up your own stories about that, but they're probably very similar to what I was doing. And so I got kicked out and I paid my fraternity dues so I could go. I had to move home and I paid my fraternity dues at the, and I would drive up to campus for the party so I could drink because that made sense. Alcohol didn't, it's still, alcohol was not registering as a problem in my life. I got back in, followed the Grateful Dead. I was a chameleon that you hear about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had long hair. Okay. So I would wear it down, wear Birkenstocks and tie-dyes and follow the Grateful Dead. I would wear my baseball hat backwards, wear my duck boots and my fraternity letters and hang out with my fraternity brothers. I would slick it back like Fabio and wear a silk shirt and a blazer, and I'd go to the clubs in DC. And I would go from group to group to group, and I would hang out and do whatever I needed to do, but nobody ever knew how bad I was getting. Do you know what I mean? And I was just having fun. And I got out of the University of Maryland and went to, I moved downtown into downtown DC. And at this point, I'd only been a cashier at a grocery store, even through college. And of all things, my sister helped me find a job, but I was just an office boy, right? I graduated, I have a degree, and the only thing I could find was being a copy boy in this small little firm downtown, but I got the job. And I moved downtown and I was like, this is going to be great. People go at happy hour and they do all this stuff and I'm excited and they weren't doing what I thought. I got this row house with a view of the Washington Monument out my back window. I'm right in the middle of the Lion's Den. It was a place called Adams Morgan, which is it's a T main streets just lined with bars and restaurants. And I was so excited. And really at this point, I will tell you my greatest aspiration. This is how high I was shooting. It wasn't family. It wasn't career. It wasn't success. It wasn't anything. At this point, I wanted to be able to go into a bar, order the usual, and have the bartender know exactly what I meant. I felt like that would have been that feeling of being like I had arrived. That was what was important to me. And I got it at a few places, but while I was in college, I started facilitating illegal transactions. Okay, I was a drug dealer. I wanted to make it sound good. I was a drug dealer, and And so I continued that when I got there. And so after that copy boy job, and during that copy boy job, I would go out and I would drink and I would do other stuff and I would come into the office and I would do stuff. And I was so hungover that I would go to the bathroom, close the door, sit on the stall and sleep. Not thinking it was a problem, thinking I was just tired, right? And then I ended up luck somehow working my way into a job with this huge international organization, right? I think my mom was prouder of me of getting this job than she was of me graduating college, because for I mean, it was a big organization and it was meaningful. I mean, it's a career job, pension, like the whole everything. And there, I think for immigrants and a lot of foreigners, there's a high value placed on working at this place. And the problem was, I got there and I found the people doing the things that I do. And we would go out. This is how crazy it was. There was a biker bar in DC, right? And then there was this club. So we would go to the biker bar for happy hour. And then we would go to the club at night, like just walk over with another block. And two totally different worlds, two totally different everything, but it didn't matter. We fit in. I ended up buying a motorcycle because I didn't have one. So, but I'll buy a motorcycle. And what would happen when I would walk into this other club is you have to walk down these stairs and then you would get right to the bar. And I would walk in and everybody would go, shoo, just like Norm from Cheers. And I would have the bartender that I knew give me a Heineken. And when I would get around the other end of the bar to the other bartender that I knew and said hi to everybody, I'd have a pint glass of Johnnie Walker Black and another Heineken waiting for me. And then I would continue to drink five, six, seven Heinekens and at least 4 or 5 points of Johnnie Walker Black on the rocks. I had no idea that that's an insane amount of alcohol, like on a nightly basis. I did not know. But that's just what we did, you know? It got to the point where I thought something was wrong and it was bad. So, and I started putting post-it notes around my apartment that just said no more. Like on my phone, on my bathroom mirror, on my computer, on the front and back of my door. And I would get home and I would last about 15 to 30 minutes and I'd start peeling them down one by one. And I would call the Chinese restaurant that delivered beer and cigarettes because we don't need food. And then I would call the guy who sold the stuff that I didn't, you know. And I believed until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, until a little while into coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was just changing my mind. Right? I have that right. I have the right to change my mind. Until I read the part in the book, it says, you know, something to the effect of, at some point in our drinking, we were drinking because we had to, not because we wanted to. And I felt like I got punched in the stomach. And people talk about the invisible line. That's it. That's literally the invisible line. I mean, if you can remember when that happens for you, great. I don't. I have no idea when that happened for me. But I can tell you that it happened because I will. It wasn't that I was changing my mind. I needed to drink. My body needed to drink. My brain needed to drink. I needed to quiet down the monster in my head. And so I wasn't changing my mind anymore. I had lost the power of choice. On March 28th of 2001, I ended up waking up ready to manage the suck. So I had come to the conclusion at this point that my life kind of sucked, right? And I was just going to manage the suck. And my relationship with God was, you're not going to make me quit like you made my dad quit. So you can kick me and you can push me down. I'm going to get up, dust myself off, and we're going to keep fighting. And on March 30th, 2001, I woke up with those guys hanging on the side of the bed, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, ready to manage the suck. I went to work and I got a call from security. They wanted me to come down and pick up a FedEx package. I intuitively knew something was wrong, A, because I wasn't expecting a FedEx package, and B, security doesn't deliver FedEx. They asked me to come down to the main building, and when I got there, the DEA was waiting for me. And they arrested me outside of this huge international organization and charged me with conspiracy to distribute MDMA, commonly known as ecstasy, as it says right across the front of my indictment. And I went from being this like DC club kid, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, right? I wore a suit during the day and I was out at the club at night, to being the best term I can use is the worst turd in the toilet bowl. I had to go home and tell my mom her son was a drug dealer. Again, that feeling of incomprehensible demoralization. She didn't raise me to do those things. And I fought that case for a year and a half. And during that time, my sister was about to get married. She postponed her wedding three times because my court date kept getting moved and we weren't going to be explained how the eldest male in our family wasn't going to be at the wedding. She didn't tell her fiance what was going on. She lied for me. And at one point, she told me that I was the most selfish person she'd ever met in her life. And I hit her back with a profanity-laced tirade that ended with, "You don't understand what my life's like." Want to talk about selfish and self-centered, right? That's me. That's what I bring to you, right? And so I fought that case, and I fought that case, and I prayed to a God I didn't believe in, because if you had my life, you'd know there's no God. I watched my mom pray every day of her life, and both her parents died when she was in India. Both her sisters died when she was in India when she was young. She came over here with her brother-in-law and he died. Her mother-in-law had lung cancer, never drank or smoked a day in her life, and her husband committed suicide. My mom had a list of health conditions that included kidney failure, heart failure. She had quadruple bypass. She had rheumatoid arthritis. She had glaucoma and she had edema. I can keep going, but I think you get the point. And I said, if that's what you get in return, that's what you get in return for prayer. Thanks, but no thanks. What's the point? But I didn't want to go to prison. So while I was fighting that case, I prayed to this God that I didn't believe in. Like it says in her big book, or I'm sorry, the 12 and 12, the kid makes a list for Santa Claus. And I fought that case, and I fought that case. I got a DUI while I was fighting that case. So I could have gone to jail while waiting to go to prison. Still didn't think alcohol was a problem. Just didn't drive for a month, right? And then I had to plead guilty. I had to plead guilty. And when I had to plead guilty, I was right. God doesn't work. God doesn't work. And I had to turn myself into the federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania on October 17th of 2002. And I got there and it was, I volunteered for the Intensive Confinement Center, which was a boot camp program so I could get some time taken off my sentence and added to parole. And I got there and, you know, I thought they'd look at my file, see I was a college graduate, where I worked and everything. And I guess they thought they would treat me different. I can assure you, when you go to prison as a drug dealer, they treat you as a drug dealer. And I got my combat boots and my army greens, and they shaved my head and we went to work, you know. And basically what it was you wake up at 5 a.m., you do PT, you march to chow. You do hard labor, you have some educational classes, then you march again, and then you eat, and then you do that from 5 a.m. to 10 p.m., right? And there's some hard labor in there. They're shoveling and doing all that. But every night after chow, you had to march for 2 hours. And so the first few Friday nights, we were marching, and I saw guys sitting in a circle in the building. They weren't marching. So I got the courage to ask one of them what they were doing, and they said they were in the AA meeting. You should volunteer. You don't have to march. I'm alcoholic. I'm not stupid. I went right to the drug counselor and said, "Can I volunteer for AA?" And she said, "Oh, you were going to go to AA. I guess I passed my intake." But what happened was an elderly woman, an elderly man with an oxygen tank came in without fear for their safety, to bring the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to a bunch of people that didn't care, could care less. We were all just trying to get over. And what happened for me was after the first few meetings that I went to, I finally asked her, "What makes you an alcoholic?" And she didn't give me phenomenon of craving, obsession of the mind, doctor's opinion. She didn't. She just said, "What do you do when you get angry? What do you do when you get jealous? What do you do when you get envious?" So you slowly commit suicide while the other person isn't thinking about you. Was like, damn. I was like, I drank at people my entire life. I drank at my mom, my dad, my sister, the guy who cut me off on the highway. The guy with 18 items in the 15 item line, right? Screw you. I'm at the, you know, watch this. I'm at the liquor store or at the bar, and they're going about their life not thinking about me. Not at all. It says in the first step in the 12 and 12, beating ourselves up with a club of anger intended for somebody else. I went back to my bunk that night and I wrote my mom a letter and I said, I don't think I'm ever going to drink again. And I took the Serenity Prayer and I prayed to that God. I made the Serenity Prayer mine and I prayed to that God I didn't believe in. And I said, God, grant me the courage to change my life, the strength to do it, and the wisdom to know it's the right thing to do. I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer. And I'm standing here with you guys 23 years later. I'm sure that God answered some of my foxhole prayers somewhere along the way, but I wasn't awake enough to ever feel it, see it, or hear it. And I didn't even realize until about 6 years sober when I was telling the story. It took me that long to even wake up in Alcoholics Anonymous to realize that that prayer was answered because I was standing in that room telling that story sober. And I'm a firm believer in the power of prayer now. I've watched a man with terminal cancer get prayed over and recover. I've had experiences where I prayed for God. Prayed to God and had it answered within. I'll tell you this. I can tell you the story. I broke up with my girlfriend, and it was selfish and it was perception. And she had gained weight and she didn't look good to me anymore, right? And this man who I used to, he was my spiritual advisor, a man named Larry O'Connor, one of the greatest men in Alcoholics Anonymous I ever met. I called him up and I said, well, but isn't this God given? This is what I'm attracted to. This is what I think, you know, what I mean, isn't this a God-given thing? And he just stopped and he said, do you think society tells us what a handsome man is, a beautiful woman is, or what a pretty couple looks like? Advertising, TV, magazines. And I, again, that feeling of getting kicked in your stomach. I was like, oh, I was like, it's not God-given. And he said, you know, I would pray that you ever get for the discernment to say the right thing if you ever get to talk to her again and leave it alone. So I was in my office. I was crying, making this prayer. And I hadn't talked to her in 2 or 3 weeks. And 15 minutes later, the phone rang. And so I was able to talk to her and we talked and she's my wife today. And so I'm a firm believer in the prayer. I'm not going to tell you that every prayer is going to get answered in 15 minutes, but I do believe in the power of prayer. I believe we're all here because somebody prayed. Mother, father, brother, sister, uncle, girlfriend, boyfriend, somebody prayed and you're here. And I think that's the greatest gift. I think it's a blessing because people don the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. And, you know, I think one of the worst sayings in AA is that it's a revolving door. Because there's a lot of people that door slam shut on. You know what I mean? It does. And so I got out of that. I got out of prison and they sent me to a pre-release center. And they told me I had to go to 3 meetings a week. And I was like, no, nah, I'm alcoholic. I understand. I'm going to one. And they said, no, you're going to three or you're going back to prison. Again, alcoholic, that's stupid. So I started to go to these meetings. And I will tell you, I did not walk in the rooms of AA and say, woohoo, you are my people. I went to these meetings and people were talking about going to jail sober, sleeping in their car sober. I mean, they were talking about stuff you don't talk about out of the house. And I was like, you are crazy. You people are crazy. Now, mind you, I am still property of the federal government. My inmate number makes me their inventory. I'm going to a pre-release center where they tell me to literally where I, when I can eat, when I can sleep, when I can come, when I can go, and I have to piss in a cup just to stay. And I'm judging the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I bring to you. Like the guilt, the shame, the selfishness, the self-centeredness, the judgment. That is my baseline, right? That is my baseline. And so I started to go to these meetings and I met, what happened was a guy that I used to drink with had disappeared for a while and my business partner. So I had started a business before I had gone to prison because I didn't think I'd ever work again. And so we worked out of his house, you know, or his apartment until I went to prison. And he had told him what was going on. This guy showed up again and he told him what was going on. And this guy told him to call me or me to call him. And I did. And And he told me that he had gotten sober. And he said he would sponsor me. You know, I was like, well, can you temporarily sponsor me? Because I wanted a home pass. I didn't want a sponsor. I wanted a home pass. And he yelled at me. It's like, screw this. Yeah, temporary, blah, blah. And I was like, whoa, dude. Like, okay. So what he did was he met me at the apartment where we were running our business out of. And he brought me lunch and he read the big book with me. That is not a big deal to anybody that's an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we do. The kicker is he actually had gotten sober, had relapsed, and was drinking at the time, but knew enough about carrying the message to an alcoholic that he came and did that for me. And he told me where to go to these meetings where they weren't just, I'm just staying sober today. He sent me to these meetings where there was an atmosphere. My sponsor talks about it, the atmosphere of recovery, where the people with time promote an atmosphere of recovery that we weren't stuck in church basements, right? That we get to live life. We just don't drink, right? We're not sentenced to anything. And he sent me to these meetings and he took me to these meetings and everything changed. Everything changed. That's where my home that those meetings, one of them became my home group. And you know, it wasn't like I was all happy and like I'm not the happy newcomer. Please don't get me wrong. I mean, I used to be pretty pretty belligerent. There was a house party, a fellow, like, it was a party after the meeting one night, and these people had, and so there was a front stoop, and I was so belligerent that I sat in the middle of the front stoop smoking cigarettes, and I would never move. People were coming, going out. Like, I was like, you're not me, and you're not making me go inside. But the people didn't, you know, nobody yelled at me. Nobody told me to do it. Yeah, I mean, they loved me till I could love myself, right? And what happened was I ended up getting off out of the pre-release center. I had an ankle bracelet on, and I got home, and I was like, I was the loneliest I'd ever been. Because I had realized that all those people that were I thought were my friends before were absolutely just clients, right? I had three friends that took care of my mom while I was gone, and they're the three friends that I still have today from back then. And then I had phone numbers in Alcoholics Anonymous that I had been collecting, and I started calling them. The night I got my ankle bracelet on, it was going to be a party. I was going to go back to the club. It was going to be Dom Perignon and Cristal. I ended up driving to a new kid to a movie with 40 other alcoholics. And then I had to drive 40 minutes the opposite direction of my house. And by the time I got home that night, I didn't drink. I got to the point where I was ready to leave Alcoholics Anonymous again. Or I guess I was going to leave. And I was like, I was miserable. I had a bad a relationship, but a relationship had ended. And this is all still about a year and a half sober. And I was, it was right after I got my ankle bracelet on. And I was like, look, I called my sponsor. I'm like, I'm done. I was on my knees praying every morning. I was crying. I was like, this doesn't work for me. And he says, you haven't done it. You haven't done anything. Because I had my ankle bracelet on. I had 15 minutes before the meeting, 15 minutes after the meeting, right? And then I had to be home. Otherwise, I was going to get arrested. And so I was coming to your meetings, drinking your coffee, eating your cookies, listening to your message, and I was going home. I wasn't participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't doing it. I was coming to the meeting. I mean, really, that comes down, that's fellowship, right? This is where we meet, we get together, and we do that. I mean, there's unity, service, and recovery. I wasn't doing any of it. And so I ended up getting three service positions in 10 days. And I started driving my sponsor's friends around all over DC. But, you know, and they wouldn't listen to me talk. You know, they made me drive them around and they would do the talking. And I, you know, we would pick them up, get to the meeting, and I'd drive them all back. And by the time I get home, it would be 11 o'clock and I wasn't thinking about drinking, you know? And that's where everything started to change for me. Did my fourth and fifth step. Again, you know, and I started to feel like I was part of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? There's a magic that happens when I feel like I do the work. I think one, two, and three are all sort of these thought process and these decisions and the way you get there. But when you take that action in the fourth step and you actually see everything, and I found out I was a scared little boy my entire life. right? Every decision was made out of fear, fear, fear. I mean, it was so, it was, and I also dated the same girl about 15 times, but there was like, there's, when you see it, there's something that happens because now you know, right? It's on paper in front of you. This isn't, it wasn't, I'm not an actor in some movie, right? I'm not, this isn't like some story or something. This is my life. I am responsible for the things that happened and the way my life is. And now my responsibility is to live the best life that God wants me to be, right? I'm trying to be the man God wants me to be, not who I want to be. And I fail short. I fail short every day. Like it talks about in the sixth step, growing in the image and likeness of my creator. I strive for that. Right? But I'm never gonna make it. God help me if I ever think that I do. But if I can move a quarter of an inch, a centimeter in that direction every day, I'm getting better. I wasn't the person that came here and put the plug in the jug and life back right. I'm sort of happy for those people. But I mean, you know, it doesn't promise that life doesn't happen, right? I've been laid off 3 times in sobriety. You know, never lost a job while I was drinking. And my mom has passed away. You know, I had a house fire. I had to kick my wife out of the house 90 days after we got married. And just things that would at any point would have made me drink before. I would have felt sorry for myself. The crazy thing is, and when most of those cases happened, like men asked me to sponsor them, right? Some of them stayed sober and some of them didn't. But I have. I don't know that it's luck or what you want to call it, but for whatever reason, when things happen in my life, I lean into Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't lean out. And I don't think it doesn't make me special. It doesn't do anything. It was maybe the way I was raised in AA. I don't, or my absolute love for Alcoholics Anonymous, my love for my sobriety. But I've always leaned in. Now, I haven't been, you know, happy, right, about the things going on. I mean, you know, I talked to the guys that I sponsor about the third step, and the third step doesn't mean that third step's easy when everything's going your way, right? Grad's great. Yes. Awesome. I've found the circumstances of my life personally objectionably most of my sobriety because they don't match up with what I want, but they're what God wants, right? Like the last time I got laid off, I was about to have my first kid. And I was like, and this is now the third time, right? So the first time I was miserable. I didn't know what was going on, blah, blah, blah. Second time, all right, God, you've made space for me to take care of your kids, this, that, the next thing. Understood. Third time, I was like, really? Like, why are we doing this again? I ended up with a 2 month severance. I used to commute from my house to Washington, D.C., which was about an hour and a half in rush hour. I got a 2 month severance. So my daughter was born, and I got to spend the first 2 months of my firstborn child's life with her every day, right? I ended up getting a job that's 20 minutes from my house. Both, okay, great. My daughter has special needs. I had to take her to preschool, so I was able to. We put her in preschool, her special development preschool with the county, but we wanted her to get exposure to normally developed kids, so we did that too. I was 20 minutes from home. I was able to leave for lunch, pick her up, have lunch with her every day, and take her to her kindergarten. That might not seem like a big deal to a lot of people. To me, it's everything. To me, it's everything. That to me is the cash and prizes in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? That's the stuff that matters. My mom, like I told you guys, we paid her peace of mind. And my mom was sick for a lot of my sobriety. You know, she had woken up one night screaming. I was living in my room from high school, and she woke up screaming one night, and for some reason I heard her, went upstairs, and she was literally saying goodbye to me and my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time. And we called the hospital and we got her heart was stopping. And you know, when my mom had recovered from her when she was recovering from a quadruple bypass, I was in the basement of my house blowing cocaine and drinking Johnny Walker. The last time she got sick, I was able to see her, and I would visit her every day in the hospital. And I went, and the last day of her life, she thanked me for being there, and I gave her a kiss, and I said, "Happy birthday, Mama." It was her birthday, and I said, "I love you," and I left, and her heart stopped like an hour later. And my daughter was so my mom's birthday is February 12th. My daughter was born on February 11th, a year later, in the same hospital. And my mom, died, they said, on February 13th, but and my daughter has a little birthmark right here. So literally a year after I left my mom in that same hospital, I was feeding my daughter in that same hospital. And she had a little heart-shaped birthmark right there. I don't know if that has anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't really care. I think it has everything to do with God. And the greatest thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that I didn't have to miss any of it. Didn't have to miss any of it, because I know without Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have missed it all. And so if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, please stay. If you've been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, please stay. If you've been here and you're not happy, Joyce, feel free, find somebody that is. Jump in their back pocket and do what they do. It says, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." That's the closest thing you'll get to a guarantee. Rarely means almost never. Do what you do, you're going to get what we get, And so the last thing I'll say is this guy, Larry O'Connor, who I told you about, he was sponsored by a guy named Brother Alexis down in DC, who's one of the giants of AA. Brother Alexis used to say, "Unspoken love and unspoken gratitude aren't worth a damn. If you're grateful, act like it. And if you love someone, tell them when their ears can hear it and their hearts can feel it." So if nobody's told you today, "I love you, I love you, I love you. Thank you for my sobriety, and thanks for letting me share."